Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first session on this beautiful day at Adelaide Writers' Week. My name is Jessica Alice. I'm the chair for this session today. I'm the artistic director of Byron Writers Festival in Byron Bay, and I was formerly the CEO of Writers SA, the State Writers Centre here. And this wonderful session, Writers and the editor relationship, is presented by Writers SA in partnership with Adelaide Writers Week. And Writers SA is, of course, a perfect resource for all writers at any stage of their career. So I encourage you to check them out if you are not yet already a member. We've just heard a wonderful welcome to country, and I'll also acknowledge that we're gathering on sovereign, unceded Kaurna Yatta, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge that this is country that has held stories and people sharing culture for millennia. And together in the spirit of language and storytelling, we're continuing that tradition, which is a privilege. So thanks for joining us for this celebration of language and ideas. I'm joined on stage by three remarkable writers from around Australia and around the world. And I'd like to introduce them all to you. Centre stage is Anjum Hassan. Anjum is the author of three novels and two short story collections, which have been shortlisted for the Indian Academy of Letters Prize, the Sahitya Akademi Award, the Hindu Best Fiction Award, and the Crossword Fiction Award, as well as being longlisted for the Man Asia Literary Prize and the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature. Her short fiction and essays have appeared in Granta, Paris Review, Los Angeles, Review of Books, and many others. Please make Anjum Hassan welcome.
Thank you.
Kate Grenville, this side of stage, the east, suddenly was just like east, west, the east side of stage. Kate Grenville is one of Australia's most celebrated writers. Her international bestseller, The Secret River, was awarded numerous prizes and has been adapted for the stage and as an acclaimed television miniseries. Her other novels include Orange Prize winner The Idea of Perfection and the best-selling A Room Made of Leaves. Her recent non-fiction includes The Case Against Fragrance and Elizabeth MacArthur's Letters. In 2017, Kate was awarded the Australia Council Award for Lifetime Achievement in Literature. Please welcome Kate Grenville.
Thanks. Thank you.
And on the western end of the panel, Madison Godfrey is a writer, editor, educator, and the author of two poetry collections. Their writing is described as sensual and often funny by The Guardian and fiercely punk and undeniably powerful by Arts Hub. Madison's recent work, Dress Rehearsals, was listed as one of the most anticipated releases of 2023 by Refinery 29, Rush Magazine, and the Sydney Morning Herald. Madison has performed poetry at the Sydney Opera House, Royal Albert Hall, St. Paul's Cathedral, and Glastonbury. Please welcome Madison Godfrey. So a very esteemed panel today, and we're speaking about perhaps one of the less visible or lesser known about process of writing and publishing, which is the relationship with an editor, and how a work goes from being the manuscript that you've been working away on for perhaps years at a time, to then undergoing that alchemy that then turns it onto the book that ends up on the shelf and in our hands and on our bedside tables. So I wanted to ask each of you about firsts. I thought we'd just start with some firsts, about the first time that you were edited. Because obviously being edited is also, it's a relationship and a skill that you become more adept with over time. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your first experience. Kate, can you tell us what it was like for you when you were just starting out as a debut?
Yes, well, my first book was a set of short stories, a few of which had been previously published but not edited. So when University of Queensland Press took on Bearded Ladies, it was my first experience with an actual proper editor. And I think perhaps like many young writers, I was all fired up to defend every precious word of what I had written. How could any word possibly be improved? So I went into it pretty spiky. And luckily, my editor at UQP was a woman called Darcy Randall, who's long since left there. And she was fabulous. She, I think looking back, massaged me, probably flattered me, took me into her confidence about various things, but above all, told me how absolutely fabulous every word of the prose was and how nothing, she wasn't going to change anything at all, which was my, you know, my guard slipped down. So when she then said, basically, she didn't put it anything like this bluntly, but I'm not as kind of tactful as she is. Basically, she said, look, it's a fabulous collection, Katie. It is so strong. It is so wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. There's just this one story that I just wonder if it belongs here or maybe it has another home. Anyway, by that time, my guard was so thoroughly down. I had been so schmoozed and flattered, which is putting it nastily. Actually, she was terrific. She was a very, probably still is, fabulously intelligent and sensitive editor. It didn't hurt at all to have an entire story removed from the collection. So I can only pay tribute to Darcy Randall and say that I was very lucky to start with her, because when I look at that story now, I think, thank God she took it out.
Any editors or aspiring editors in the audience, take note. Step one is flattery, and then step two is yep. Whatever you want. Anjum, how about you?
Yeah, I started by writing reviews and essays. Are you all right?
Yeah, sorry, I just...
No worries, yeah. And got to fiction a little later in my career, and I remember the first time ever I was published in an anthology of travel writing. And I had little bits of poetry published in journals. I'd had a short story published in an anthology, and nobody ever mention the word editing. And that says a lot about the editing culture in India 15 years ago. I think we've moved a long way from there. It's still much less developed than it could be, but it's improved hugely. I've hopefully improved hugely, but I still remember that moment when I was accepted for that anthology and the thrill of being in this book, and the editor was herself at that point a pretty well-known poet, and she sent back these very gentle suggestions to change a few things. It wasn't about redoing the piece at all. She liked it. She loved the intent of it. It was very, very minimal, and I was just devastated. I cried. I thought she hated me. I hated her. And I'm just thinking of my reaction, how visceral it was. And cut to last year, 2023. I'm writing now for the New York Review of Books. It's very new. I'm just two pieces old there. And you get edit 6. There's no indication of whether this is you're midway in the process or you're reaching the end. It's just that we are going to work on this piece till it's ready to go. And they don't bother with topicality and meeting deadlines. They can carry a review of a book that appeared a couple of years ago, so there's absolutely no newsroom pressure. And we're still sort of polishing the joins and, you know, working out if every little piece of logic is absolutely sound. Mm. And I love it, because every time I think, okay, now I'm done, I absolutely can't improve this piece anymore, I'm losing my mind. And then you come back, they come back, and I say, how did I miss this? And thank God they spotted this little niggling thing that just would have made the piece less effective, less convincing than it will be now. So certainly there's been a journey, a very, very, very long journey in a relatively short time. And then I've had very good editors with my novels, but maybe I'll talk about that a little later and let Madison talk about her highs and lows before that. Yeah.
Yeah, so Madison, how about you?
So my
first experience of editing was mostly working as an editor before I was published in a full collection. There's a small magazine called Voiceworks. It's run by Express Media, and it's run by young people for young writers. So all of the editors are 25 or under, and I think I edited it probably when I was maybe 22 I started. Funnily enough, I submitted to Voiceworks repeatedly before that, and I didn't get in once. Not once. And I love telling my students this now as a teacher. The best thing about Voiceworks, though, is every unsuccessful submission still gets a feedback email. It's a huge workload, and it really sucks your soul out of you just doing it repeatedly. But it taught me a lot about, like, holding space for that feeling of the vulnerability and the feeling of the stubbornness. The other thing that happened there was I was repeatedly given our youngest writers. I'm not sure why. In hindsight, I just love working with young people. So I was often given like 14-year-old writers who were publishing their first poems ever, which was so exciting. And some of them have gone on now to like win prizes and be quite well known. And it's the most gorgeous feeling. So when I came to being edited, I feel like I was very familiar with my own stubbornness through that lens and my own vulnerability through that lens. Because you do have young writers sending emails back that are like, hey, like, I don't agree with this. And like, even with those general feedback emails, I love that. Like, let's stay fiery and respectful, but fiery. And so when it came to being edited for my own work, it was really interesting because I started to see it as a real honor because I knew about the time that had gone into it. I think editing for me is not just reading a piece and adding track changes, but reading a piece, sitting with a piece, letting it kind of almost fester inside of you and then returning to it with feedback. And I think as someone who had kind of learnt that process and learnt that it is a generosity and a compassion to be critical, when it came to getting that critical feedback, my rage, you know, swelled up and then eased very quickly because I was like, what an honour to have somebody care enough about my work that they would put their own expertise, their own critique and their own brain power into making it a little bit better. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Kate, you've published a number of novels over your career, and I think with a few different publishers. I wonder if you could describe the relationship with your editors. Is it how close that is if you work with someone over time, and how that back and forth works? Maybe perhaps, and the difference, I suppose, with maybe your structural editor and the relationship with a line editor, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a really good distinction because for me they've been kind of radically different experiences. Mm. Editors, look, I've had relationships at two ends of the spectrum. A couple of my books were published with Picador with Hilary McPhee, who is a kind of name to conjure with in editing. And I vividly remember the first day we sat down. She's a structural editor, certainly not a line editor, at my dining room table with Dark Places, which is a challenging book. It was a challenging book to write and probably the book I'm most proud of, actually. Anyway, Hilary and I sat down and I expected her to say, look, you know, if you did this, if you did that, you know, maybe you should do this and that. She didn't. There was a long silence, and then she said, look, I'm just looking at page 43. So I turn to page 43, and I look at what looks to me like a page of perfect prose. And she says, just that second paragraph there, nothing more. She didn't say, it didn't ever say anything else, but my eye went to paragraph 2, and I suddenly read it through the cold eyes of someone who had not written it. And looking at it through those eyes, I saw it completely differently. And that totally, Hilary never said anything more than second paragraph, page 43, of all the many changes we made to that book. It was a masterstroke because, a bit like judo, it actually harnesses your own energy, your own weight, to look at the thing in a different way. So that, I think, was the extreme of hands-off editing. Once I moved to text, I've had Michael Haywood as my big picture editor, and he does something called turning the pages, where you're both, at a table or on the phone, and you're literally turning the pages quite quickly. You're not stopping at any sentence or paragraph. And he's asking very big questions that are tied to the actual text. So he's the opposite of Hillary in a way. And when we finally did... at one point, Michael and I spent an entire week on the phone together. This is with The Secret River, which is my first book with text. An entire week on the phone together, going through literally every sentence of that book. And there's no question, it's a very much better book. My ear, at the end of that week, it took about a month to recover from being pressed. This was pre-mobiles, pressed to the receiver. The other thing there... Look, no, I'll give somebody else a go.
Go on. What are you doing?
Well, look, The Secret River was a transformative experience because what he said... It's about a husband and wife who come to Australia as convicts, basically. And I was very interested in the man because Australian history has always been about the men. And although I've written a book called Joan Makes History to put the women back in, it felt like the narrative drive was going to be the man's story. So that's the story I'd told when I gave the book to Michael. He said, he didn't say, look, you should do X, you should do Y. He just said, there's an opportunity here to do something else. You don't have to, but there's an opportunity. And the opportunity was... The wife had arrived in Australia whinging, basically, nagging her husband to go back. So she'd arrived, you know, bellyaching about being in Australia, and for the rest of the book, all she had done was whinge. Mm. And I suddenly saw when he said that, yeah, I've got an opportunity here. She can do something other than just whinge. She can also have a journey towards understanding of what it's like to be in this new place. So the book has been very successful, and I give Michael huge credit for that. Mm. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
Thank you.
I want to read The Secret River.
Maddie, your latest book, Dress Rehearsals, is... how do we describe its form or genre? It's a poetic memoir?
Yeah, the cover says, a memoir made of poetry.
Yeah.
Which is also just a lovely little tagline.
Yes.
Technically, it's in three parts, and it documents a decade of performing womanhood from my early experiences as a fangirl in punk music and emo mosh pits from 15 onwards, screaming in those tiny dark rooms... onwards to now, who you probably see here or saw 2 years ago, and my experience as a queer person, as a non-binary person, and as someone still trying to find joy in femininity. And it's done through prose poems, which are poems that look like paragraphs, like really chunky, so they fill the page. I get very excited about prose poetry, so I won't tell you everything and I won't do a full TED talk, but really quickly, it's just very exciting because you open it and you think it's a paragraph and then you're tricked and it's a poem. And so when I think about the idea of performing gender or performing femininity, that's kind of what the work does as well. In relation to editing, though, that book was the creative outcome of my PhD last year, that I finished last year. It came out before the PhD was submitted. For those of you who are in academia or who know the PhD process, that's a little bit saucy. And it also means there were too many cooks in the kitchen of the editorial room, very much, because I had three supervisors in my PhD, which is also too many cooks. Yes, people are grimacing, like people who know this are like, that's too many cooks. And then I also had, like Kate said, the big picture editor, and then I had a tiny picture editor, and then an amazing publication team as well. So yeah, it was a lot of cooks in my kitchen.
And so how did that work? So your supervisors would have been looking at the at the creative work and the thesis and perhaps making some creative suggestions there.
Yeah.
And then you had a book editor.
Yep.
So you've got your supervisors who are looking at it as a piece of scholarly artistic output, and then you have editors who are looking at it as a book product.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Thankfully for me, my PhD editors very much trusted me. I had already published quite a lot and have worked as an editor ongoingly since that first Young Mag. And so there was kind of a level of trust to what I was doing creatively. I did have an amazing prose poetry supervisor who's located at Deakin called Cassandra Atherton, who really just prodded, sort of like Kate said, sort of was like not so much telling me what to do, but was prodding and saying, do you need this? are you sure? Are you over-explaining? And I love those, are you over-explaining mm-hmm. is one of my most profound questions to be asked, because I always am. And then in terms of the Allen and Unwin process, who's my publisher, Dress Rehearsals was the first book out of an imprint called Joan. It's the new imprint by Nakia Louie. It started last year. I was the first one. And because of that, there was also an interesting editorial gaze of what does it mean to be the first book out of an imprint led by a First Nations woman in this country, named after her grandmother, and a tribute to resilient and uncomfortable and difficult and challenging stories. So, yeah, it was a bit. However, what I really enjoyed was finding a way to make a scholarly product not feel scholarly at all. And that's sort of what I hope I've done and what I believe I've done with the poetry book, is it's sort of meant to be a poetry book for people who've never been to a university or never had the experience of reading a poem and feeling included, or reading a poem and feeling like they are smart enough to understand. And so the editorial process was also a conversation about that. Mm. How do we make these poems invitations rather than alienations? Mm. Yeah. Which is fun.
Anjum, your latest novel, History's Angel, is about a history teacher in India who is Muslim, although maybe not a practicing Muslim. And a lot of the book follows the experience of Muslims in India who are, though still an enormous population, like I think maybe 2 million people, perhaps.
200 million.
200, sorry, I forgot a couple of zeros. But are still, so an enormous population, but still a minority within the country, which is primarily Hindu. I wondered about the experience of editing this book within the publishing industry, which, you know, as any industry will in any country, will have some of the same social and political and religious issues playing out among the industry itself. So I wondered about the process of writing and editing this book and the experience of that, both as creating the work with an editor, but then also the release of the book.
Yeah. So like you said, Jessica, it is the adventures of a history teacher in today's India, more specifically in today's Delhi. Because I don't live in Delhi, but I felt if I'm going to talk about what's going on politically, even if that's just the backdrop, it would have to be North India, where I think this is playing out in a much more crucial, urgent, sort of maybe even dangerous way. And that is why I set the novel in Delhi, and Delhi is also where almost the entire publishing industry is for English language writing. And there would be people reading that book who live in that city and know it well. So to me, that felt like an advantage in some ways. It was very warmly received across the board, and there was at least three publishers who wanted to have it, and we finally went with Bloomsbury. And there was never any question of holding back or saying this might be too radical a thing to say, so cut it out. Or so there were, none of the conversations were ever about censoring what I'm saying. And to be fair to the book, it is not a stridently political book at all. Because like you said, my character is really, he's a liberal Indian caught in a time where the liberal Indian is really becoming a kind of anachronism. And it's Alif's attempt, that's his name, Alif Muhammad, it's his attempt to sort of hold on to that core of just being this sort of open-minded, dreamy, thinking, meditative figure. And all around him, very, very audibly and visibly, it's on the television, it's the news headlines, it's the conversations in his own work environment, in the family, the conversations are all about the debates are all about this. What does it mean to be a Muslim in today's India? He's hearing it all the time on the television. Then luckily the television breaks down and the family can move on to more everyday things. So that's definitely there, but it's also the comedy, or at least the absurdity of hearing that being beamed at you when you're not just that, obviously. You're living your life, you're a human being in all its complexity. So I think the editor who I went with finally, Shiva Priya at Bloomsbury, really recognized it as a very, very alive novel, alive to the moment, but not necessarily making any obvious political arguments. And she totally responded to that. But I had an experience very similar to Kate's, which is that Alif was my man, and he was going to be the hero of the book, and I was investing all this emotion in him, and his wife was just going to be the foil. And in every way different, she's very practical, hard-headed, she wants to get a better job, she wants to move out of that old quarter of the city where they live. She's just got her eye on the future. And I was talking about this yesterday as well, and I said, and in Sydney where I gave a talk a few days ago, and I was saying, as I started writing her, I realized she has to be more than that. It can't be that she's just this obvious opposite. And I took all the credit, but the fact is that it was actually my editor, Shiva Priya, who read it and loved it and wrote me one of the most beautiful mails I've ever got from an editor, because she responded so emotionally and personally, you know. And I think in these matters now in India, you are responding personally to a book that's talking about identity and communalism and politics. But all of that aside, when that was maybe a bit of the flattery as well, but when we got down to business, completely different, very much more hard-hitting tone. And she said, Tahira is just not working. That's the wife's name. You need to do more with her. She definitely has more potential. And I realized that I had really, really, really underestimated the character. And I hope, I think, given the response of the readers so far, that she is a much more complex, interesting, emotional in her own way character than she would have been if Shiva Priya didn't make that very clear intervention saying, do more with the woman.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, editors really do, in some ways, save us from ourselves.
Yeah.
They pick up on these things that can make such a difference.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about, you touched on it a little bit, but I'm always struck by how often you get these incredibly progressive books coming out of India, and some of them are much more explicitly political. Mm. But I'm interested in, with the Modi government and being quite conservative, shall we say, your take on Indian publishing in that environment?
I think it's the best time for publishing. That's the curious thing. Because partly it's just been an engine of its own. It's been growing. There are many more publishing houses working in English. And I'm only going to be talking about English because that's the field that I know well. All the major languages have their own thriving reading and writing and publishing spheres, which I can't comment on at this point. But English has, like I said, when I started, it was still relatively small. It used to be even smaller in the 90s, and 80s is when it really even started properly. So it's very new still. But today, I always think that, could there be, because I've also worked as an editor myself, not in publishing, but in a magazine as books editor, and I'm always thinking, could there be some incredible novel sitting in some drawer that we haven't heard of simply because there isn't an editor with a nose for it? And actually, every time I think of that, my answer is no. Because I feel if there's a really good novel, the field being what it is now, it will find its way to a publishing house. And so I don't know if there are books being turned down that are very, very outspoken in ways that make people comfortable. Editors, I have known editors and publishers to say that we do a legal check. We do ask people to think about what they're saying in this environment. I think as a fiction writer, maybe it's a little different. I'm not a political commentator. I'm not writing works of political reportage. Maybe it's different for that. But like you said, the fact remains that very, very outspoken books are still appearing and will continue, I think, to appear. There's no way that our freedoms can be curtailed to that extent. I hope not. And one of the reviews I got just the other month, it started by saying that listing recent books that have appeared, fiction and nonfiction, that are actually looking at what it feels like to be living under the present government. And the reviewer said just the fact that these books are appearing is actually grist for the other side's mill, because they can say, look, we're letting you speak. All these books are around. So you can't say that, you know, it's a dark time, because we haven't gagged you yet. You're still talking.
Fascinating. I just want to let you all know that we will have time for questions in just a few minutes, and we'll have a roving microphone around. So you can have a think if there's anything that you want to ask these wonderful writers. I wanted to ask for all of you, when you're in the writing process, are you thinking about your readers and the book as a product, I suppose? I'd love to know about when you're in the creative process, maybe not so much when you're starting a new work, but perhaps when you're moving through it, are you thinking about how it will be read at all? And that's for anyone to jump into.
I think I've had to stop. I think it's something I've really tried to unlearn. Coming up as a performance poet, so my early career was all through slam poetry and live performance, and I toured a lot internationally performing my work. I had this relationship with an audience, like a literal audience, that I was constantly in conversation with them, and my work was very much a live thing. You know, I was handing it to them and feeling how they held it, how they received. I could see on their faces what was funny, what was concerning, what was grotesque. And so over the last 5 years, stopping performing, I've really had to make my writing space and my writing room, whatever room that may be, a place of mirrors and a place where I'm constantly having to look at myself deeper and deeper if writing about myself. And if writing about someone else or writing in fiction, I still want it to be a place where I feel like I'm kind of reverberating with the work itself before I hand it to someone else. I think it's challenging also having the editor in my brain in the room as well, and I try to see that as a strength sometimes. It makes the work cleaner in general. It makes it generally easier to edit when it gets to an editor, because I've kind of had that strictness on myself. Mm-hmm. But more and more over the last few years, I've found this real joy in getting to write and not thinking about an audience and not thinking about a reader in that initial draft. So not until it's being... I don't give things to publishers until it's ready is another thing that's been quite beautiful. And giving myself that honour also feels like an integrity with myself and a relationship that I have with my writing that feels really special and I'm really grateful for now. Mm. Yeah.
It wasn't until I published my first novel, Lillian's Story, that I realised that I had crossed a boundary. I was no longer a virgin. And anything that I wrote in the back of my mind was now the thought, this might be published. Whereas before that, I'd never really considered that. I thought maybe I'd get a novel published when I was 50 or something. And I realised that it was having an absolutely paralysing effect on my imagination. So since then, I have devised a whole orchestra of strategies to pretend that no one will ever read this, to re-virginate myself in a way. So I do things like, for example, I often write by hand, and since I have such terrible handwriting, that's quite safe. No one is going to read that. Like Madison, I never show anything to anybody until it's really gone as far as I can possibly go with it, because after that it's a different experience. So I think that although obviously it's a process of kidding myself, I'm pretending that I'm just writing for myself, even though in fact, of course, if the publisher said, oh, no, you had a good time writing it, but no one else is going to read it, I would be shattered. So somehow I hold, as perhaps you do too now, this kind of double thing. You know, Stephen King... You know, you could hardly be a better selling author than Stephen King. He says you should write the first draft with the door closed. I would add perhaps the first 20 drafts with the door closed, and only then open the door and let readers in. I think that's really good advice. Yes.
I often say, touching on that, if I had thought of Dress Rehearsals, my recent book, as a book that was going to be public, I didn't have that in my mind at all. Mm-hmm. It would not be like it is. It is a very grotesque graphic book that my mum has read multiple times. And I think if you write in a room where you know your mother is going to read it, it will not turn out like that book did. Yes, so I'm very grateful for the fact that I completely tricked myself into feeling that they were just poems that I would read to myself and
that's
no one else.
The good test, the mother test, mother yeah. in the same room test.
No mum in the room. Yeah.
The family test in general is, yeah. is interesting. In my case, I don't think I've worried so much about mother or father, but... and it's been a little the reverse, I think, because over time my first reader and editor and sounding board has been my husband, who would also make me cry in the beginning because I was so unused to being criticized. But over time I've got used to his brutality with the text, and he's coming from a very different culture of sharing one's work, and It's almost workmanlike, the approach to writing, because he grew up in Sweden. He writes in Swedish, and he went to creative writing school, which seemed to be all about people sitting and taking apart each other's work. And I've never studied writing in any formal way, so he just couldn't understand my sensitivity, and I couldn't understand his so-called objectivity. But now we've made peace, and I have to say that I can't imagine letting out a piece of writing into the world till it's past the Zach filter, because he really picks out things that I miss, and he's good with all sorts of things, from idiom to facts to, again, the flow of the argument. He's was a fiction writer before I ever thought I would be one, so I am scarily dependent on him now for reading my work before it goes out. And of course, I am doing my best with it before even he reads it. So he is very close, but he still is even if he's the ideal reader, he is the reader. He has to read a finished piece of work. But in a larger sense, having written three novels, this one's actually the fourth, and books of short stories and so on, I think somewhere in the larger atmosphere, there is the idea of a reader. There is the sense when I'm writing that I don't know who this eventual public will be, but I am writing to communicate. I'm trying very hard to get across. And in that sense, I'm not writing for myself. I want to communicate joy. I want to communicate incident. I want people to be pulled into the story. And why would I be doing all that for myself? Mm-hmm. I am doing it for you. So there is this larger inspiration, let's say, or pull somewhere in the world, and that's leading me on. But yeah, it is still a very, very, very private business. That's just where you want to end with the reader.
Mm. And what about when you've all mentioned some wonderful editorial interventions that strengthened your works? How do you know when to maybe push back against a comment or a suggestion from an editor? How do you make the call of when actually I'm going to stand by this one? Or you know, when you take some of the advice and maybe leave others, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really hard. I'm not good at pushing back enough with line editors. Line editors have a job. It's a bit like line editors, I think, have the job to say, for example, this sentence doesn't have a finite verb. And then they should say, is that what you want? And at that point, you can say yes or no. But I have had experience of editors who have gone to the wire fighting me on such things as, you know, sentence without a finite verb. And at that point, most of my books, I can turn to the page where I lost the battle and I deeply regret it,
yes.
Particularly with fiction. Mm. It's, you know, the book is on the shelf forever, I tell myself now, but I'm still just as bad, because I think an editor's comment like that taps into something unconscious in ourselves, which is the profound self-doubt that I can't be the only human on the planet to feel. And so when they say, this isn't going to cut the mustard, you think, oh my God, they're right, I must change it. Whereas actually, they may not be right, and maybe you have to fight back.
And so particularly on that note, Kate, I mean, if you're talking about grammar as well, I mean, so part of it is about style.
Yep.
Mm. So how do, you know, and particularly, I suppose, also in prose poetry, the rules of grammar are in many ways out the window.
Yeah, also being the first contemporary poetry book published by Allen and Unwin was a moment in punctuation for everyone involved. And I also got to choose my editor, which was a really, like, I don't think many writers get that. It was a real privilege. And I chose Fiona Wright, who many of you may know as an essayist and a poet and just an amazing person. And so I also can tell you every single comma I thought about in the whole book. The thing about me and my brain, which is a bit bizarre, is that I probably still can. I know every word in my book by heart. It's all memorized. And so when it came back to pushing back, my thing was I took all the edits and I accepted them all, and then I waited a few weeks, and I can tell you what bits stuck in my memory and what didn't. And so if the version I remembered still had that word or still had that pause, and in poetry, a comma or a line break is often a breath. So if I remembered it and felt like it needed that breath, I pushed back and I kind of fought and said, look, I know realistically there's not meant to be a comma there. I know it's an extra comma, and I know in the rules of everything it's wrong. However, like, that comma is a limb. I think you have to pick the battles with the whole book as well. Is that I think you might have found you can push back on certain things and kind of have, there's a negotiation as well. But I found that what I remembered and what stuck with me and the music of the work was my kind of lineation of what's worth fighting on and what's actually a great edit. And like you've both said, I'm really grateful for the parts that were cut, and I'm grateful for the ways that this book does not contain some works which in hindsight were undercooked. A little bit raw in the middle. They were not good chicken. Yeah.
Did you say chicken?
Yeah, like I don't.
I just remembered something when you said, just triggered a line edit memory.
I'm sorry,
no, it's a funny. It was a funny recollection because we were talking about pushing back. Actually, Kate, about style and how much do you trust yourself and how insecure are you about language? And for History's Angel, I had a wonderful line editor who really, I think, improved my language and made me feel even more insecure than I already am about the English language. And then there's Aleph's mother, the protagonist's mother, in the kitchen, and they're having this little conversation while she's cooking chicken. As you often do when you're making a curry, you're roasting the spices, you fry the onions and you're roasting the spices, and then you put in the meat. And it's a quartered chicken, and she throws it in, and I say that the chicken lies there pell-mell, looking strangely out of place, and then it gives up its animal appearance and becomes merely food. So I say it lies there pell-mell, which to me sounded just the way a chicken would look, which was thrown in, just thrown in while she's having this pretty agitated conversation with her son. And so my editor says, you can't use pell-mell like that. That's not what a chicken would be in that situation. And I say, of course, you must be right. How could I have misused pell-mell? And she takes it out, and we're almost going to press, and then I'm reading John Berger, the great art critic, someone whose work I really admire, and he uses pell-mell in exactly the same way. The thing that is pell-mell in that sentence, I don't remember it, is not moving. It's still pell-mell. And I rush back to her and I say, look, John Berger has used pell-mell like this. And then we have a little argument about it. And then she says, do you want me to put it back? I said, yes, please put it back.
Oh, so, well done.
Pell-mell is still in the book.
Good. And I should say as well that, Anjum, you have some beautiful sentences in History's Angel. They're quite long sentences,
you,
and there's a beautiful poetic musicality to that.
Thank
and I thought that would be, you'd really want an editor who understands the beauty of a sentence in that way.
Yeah, so that was the slight other argument, because people tend to want to cut my sentences into manageable bits, discrete units, and I'm like, no, the euphony, the music, like you said. So that can be hard sometimes, because I think not everyone, I think editors can sometimes feel they're losing control with very long sentences, and so that's sometimes a battle. But overall, I think I'm better with editors than without.
Absolutely. We have some microphones. If there are just coming up the center of the aisle. All right, we have a few over here that I can see. So we might start with a couple of questions here, and then I think I saw one over there. So we'll go this way. So just over here. And a reminder to everyone to be respectful, zero tolerance for racism or any bad behaviour, and please ask a question.
Thanks very much. Well, I had two questions, but you've asked the first one, which was going to be a bit blunter, which was, have you ever had a bad editor and what have you done with it? And the second question is kind of related. It seems I like to pick an author and then read everything. And it seems to me that with some very well-established authors, the editors just let them go. And you read the book and you think, I wish something had been taken to this. It's good, but it needs pruning in some way or another. So I wonder if you have any comment on that, on editorial practice, especially with established authors.
Yeah, look, I haven't noticed any kind of sacredness in dealing with myself as an established author, I have to say. No holding back and saying, no, you've got to get rid of this, Kate. But look, what your comment about pruning, I was a good little girl at school and I learned that the proper way to write an essay was to start with a topic sentence and then, you know, say what you're going to say, say it, then tell the reader what you said, which is fantastic for school essays. But what Michael Haywood pointed out to me was that I tend to do that in fiction as well, which is a killer. So it's like each writer, I think, has their kind of habitual problems, and that's certainly one of mine. And so it can really help when somebody doesn't let you get away with that. Yep.
Yeah.
I think I'll pass this one because it might bring out a barrage of feeling the same as you reading, especially I think male writers who are very established and feeling exactly like you do. So, but I won't get into examples and things.
Wow.
Maybe you'll get those at the signing tent if you're lucky.
Can't wait. I feel this as well occasionally reading where I'm like, please, little edit and just like make it happen. I really strongly dislike when I feel editors being gentle with me. And often it's for reasons that we don't intersect with identity rather than my experience, or they will feel that by editing me, they are enforcing some sort of like power dynamic or gender binary or all of these things. And I'm like, no. Like the biggest respect I can get is a harsh edit. I love it, a juicy, you know? And I can talk about it and we can fight and we can engage in a dialogue. And that for me is the ultimate respect and what I hope to have forever. And for me, one of the reasons I specifically chose Fiona was I knew she would be rough on me, and she has been, and it was hard and good. But I want that, and I feel that the gentleness and the idea of prestige can often be treated as like a lack of respect, even though it's cases like, oh, I'm being respectful by being gentle. Yeah, and Kate's books are brilliant because of that ongoing relationship with harsh critique, you know, and this like lineage of that. How boring if you started being like just mollycoddled and smothered into, yeah. So yeah, I do feel it. I hope anyone who's in the room, no more, be brutal. We love it, respectfully brutal. Yeah.
There's another question over here.
Thank you all. I was just wondering if you could give us your thoughts on how you see the publishing industry and the issue of cultural appropriation. I know quite a number of writers where this has happened and others that have stopped writing because they've been told, no, you're not going to get published. Have you detected any movement along those lines where works are being knocked back because of this issue?
We could probably maybe interpret that or reframe the question perhaps in a slightly different way, which might be about maybe just about some of the considerations of your own work, which might be about your authorial voice. I'd perhaps wonder about when we're writing from our own experiences, do we think about that more or less? Maybe that's Maddie, in your book, you've written about there are some personal experiences in that. Do you think about it in a broader cultural way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a publisher, so I don't know what happens in the room and what gets put in what pile. I'd love to, like, get me be a fly on the wall, and I think it's interesting. I definitely think the move towards own voices and nothing about us without us and these kind of narratives that we're talking about a lot are really important to discuss. My book being framed as a memoir often positions that as being my experience, and I think if those of you who've read it or will read it will know more about me if you do. People who've come up to me this week have been like, oh, I love the book. I'm like, you know a lot about my body. You know a lot of intimate details, and it's lovely to meet strangers who know my intimate body so well. And so, in a way, I mean, it's a joke, but it's also a beautiful thing to know that so many private domains of my life have been received so well by so many, and it's been a really interesting experience of the relatability of the personal. We go back to that very integral feminist statement of the personal is political, and I think it's a really important thing that I try to remember with writing, with editing, with teaching, is that some of our most interesting stories are the most boring things about us. You know, I'm always like, stop writing me the big poem and tell me how you brush your teeth or why you love the person you love. And I think there is also these like big labels that are put on the work of like queerness or like feminism. And I love those labels. I agree with them, but I'm way more interested in the tenderness. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about those big kind of labels we put on things, I almost want to bring it back and say, why is my relationship with my mum so important? Why is she my best friend? And I think that's also more interesting sometimes.
Yeah, beautiful. We are almost out of time, so we'll just try and squeeze one more question in. If we have one over there. Oh, just here. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for today. It's been really interesting. Thanks for today. It's been very interesting. Have you ever been asked to change your title? And if you were, how attached are you to it? Or if you could be, would that be very challenging? How important is your title to you?
You have touched a nerve with me, speaking frankly. There are many titles, and I have to say many covers, which I would give a great deal of money to have a chance to perhaps, have another conversation about it, let's say. Yep.
Your titles?
Yeah, no, I've not ever had titles changed. Covers, yes. I've had to fight about covers and lost battles over covers, so definitely embarrassed about some covers. Titles, actually, I've been helped out by editors. I have a book of stories called Difficult Pleasures, and I couldn't for the life of me think of a title for it. And I was just tearing out my hair, and there was a writer on a panel yesterday, I think it was Patrick DeWitt, saying, if you have a book where the title is the title of the leading character or one of the characters, the insider secret is you couldn't come up with a better title, so that was a compromise or a fallback. Mm. And I was verging on that with this short story collection, just using something, name of one of the characters as the title for the whole book. And my editor at that time, another wonderful, one of the two who I really respect and can't do without, Chiki Sarkar, she just picked out this phrase from a sentence in one of the stories, and there were 12 stories, and I still think, how did she do it so intuitively? And it's this widower who's on this trip, going back to the places he had traveled to when his wife was alive, and he's trying to be more social than he has been and talk to people, but it's still difficult, and he says, it's such a difficult pleasure talking. Mm. And she just picked that phrase up, and I thought it really, it captures the book so well. So yeah, again, editors have, I mean, they play very, very critical. I think more and more this conversation is about how critical they are than how you're resisting them. In this case, certainly, she really helped out.
It's a great title.
Thank you.
Beautiful. All right, we are absolutely out of time. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panel, Kate Grenville, Anjum Hassan, Madison Godfrey. You can catch all of them at the Book Tent. Please support our authors by buying a book. Kate's is Restless Molly Maunder, Anjum's is History's Angel, and Maddie's is Dress Rehearsals. Thanks all, and we'll see you here in another 15 minutes for the next session. Thank you.
Thank you.